Is Gene gone too?
Gene's gone.
He's on vacation.
I'd like to call this evening's Monroe City Council meeting to order, please. Elizabeth, could you please call the roll?
Certainly, council members present and establishing a quorum are Kovak, Rasmussen, Hansen, Gamble.
Okay, will everybody please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. The first item that we have on the agenda this evening is a presentation, sort of Q&A, as well as a presentation from our representative, Dan Christensen.
Right here?
Yes. Thank you very much for coming this evening. And we are looking forward to any sort of an update of how things went with the last legislative session and any sort of things that you see coming up on the horizon for this coming legislative session. And I'm sure the council members will have some questions.
Well, hopefully some hard balls to be thrown at me. Prepare. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. This is actually the first time in 12 years in the legislature I've had to testify in front of a city council, and I've only got a dozen of them that overlap into my legislative district, so you guys are setting a new base level for all the other cities. So I want to thank you for having me here. You know, we were of course, challenged by many different issues this last legislative session, but most of those issues are more on the heels of the previous session. This was a short session, which is a session where we're supposed to be dealing with changes to the economy, emergencies, things like that, not the big budget. The big budget had already been written and passed, by the way, with the largest yes vote in more than a quarter of a century in our state. And so there was a lot of collaboration that took place between both sides of the aisle, and even the Senate and the House of Representatives started to work together, which is also, that was a lot to get that to happen. But we did pass what I would say was probably one of the more sustainable budgets we've seen in a long time. It's the first time, 2013 was the first time, and again in 2014 here was the first time since 2008 we weren't going backwards on the revenue end. And so, of course, that was something that helped us out quite a bit. But the collaboration was something that was kind of groundbreaking for many of us. We had not seen in the past, at least in my tenure there, had not seen both sides, both Democrats and Republicans, House and Senate, working together as well as they did. And we not only were discussing, you know, the big aspects of the budget, whether it was going to be money going towards education, which is the number one spending issue that we have to deal with, but also health and human services issues, public safety, transportation, all those things were talked about. But what had not happened in the previous 10 years is we had not gotten into the line-by-line item issues, which is something I know at a local level you have to do on a regular basis. Down in Olympia, we deal with budgets and silos. But what had not been talked about is what was in the silo. We knew how much money was going in, but we didn't know how it was being spent. And so we spent weeks going through that, literally, line by line, and let's just say massaging the budget a lot. So I kind of liken it to needs versus wants. And I've talked about that before, but every one of us, you know, in our personal budgets and even at the local level, we have that needs versus wants list that we have to go through that exercise of what absolutely do we have to do versus what is it we want to do. And I would say it's probably the first time since I've been there that we actually started that exercise. Now, that being said, getting through the budgetary process last year and then being faced with the challenges we had this year, we were dealing with things like marijuana. You know, you've got an initiative that passed. Every year that I'd been in the legislature, they had tried to legalize marijuana through the legislative process. Every year that I was there, it failed. And the reason why it continued to fail year after year after year was the struggles that we're dealing with now in trying to figure out how do we make it work. You know, one of the things that stopped us moving forward on the marijuana issue was the fact that what was taken out of the bill in the Senate was the local aspect of this. If it's going to be the local governments that have to deal with the public safety aspect of this. It's going to be the local police departments, both at a city and a county level, that have to take care of this. And there was no money in there for that. And so that was a non-starter for most of us anyway when we found out that it came out of the Senate without any of the local aspects of it. I would probably say, though, that the marijuana struggle is not going to be over for a long time. Mm-hmm. I see chiefs here in the audience and can attest to this. I'm also dealing with the military on this a lot because the military has a zero tolerance. We have one of the largest military presences in the world here in Washington State, and they have a zero tolerance on marijuana. These are the challenges we faced as legislators through the legislative process that continue to kill it, and I would say this is probably the closest thing in our lifetimes that we've seen to prohibition, what they must have gone through upon the legalization of alcohol and all the local, state, you know, not only constitutions at state levels, but the local municipal, you know, all the laws and rules that the states and municipalities all put together, trying to make sense of that based on what the people have approved. And that will continue to be a big challenge for us. You know, there was transportation, of course. And transportation is a huge issue out here. Of course, we just had this double fatality on 522. It's personal to all of us. I've lost a personal friend. Both my brothers were hospitalized for weeks in a head-on collision years ago. And so if you've been in this valley for any period of time, you know that this is a big issue out here. It continues to be a challenge for me when I deal with other legislators and the executive office, the governor's office, when they continue to put together priorities of transportation. Our safety is always at the top of the list, number one or number two issue. Yet they will not put Highway 2 on the list. That's very difficult for me. I did, though, and I want to make sure that you're clear on this and that you understand, one of the things that we've been working on is we need to know, because this is not something that's being talked about a lot when it comes to transportation. There's a social economic challenge that we deal with on the whole transportation budget that needs to be discussed, and I think at a local level that it's something that you all need to be talking about. I've talked to many of my other city officials about this and county officials, but as soon as you start getting out of the metropolitan areas, you have a population of people that are what we would call today underemployed. Since 2008, a lot of these people lost their jobs. For almost a year, the 39th district here had more people collecting unemployment checks than any other district in the state for nearly a year. Most people are not aware of that. But we have a very high percentage of aerospace employees, but we also have a very high percentage of construction-related jobs out here. To date, the construction-related jobs are still almost 30% unemployment to date. Now, these people may have found another job after they exhausted all of their unemployment resources, may have had to change careers, but now we have this huge population outside the metropolitan areas in Washington State that are what we call underemployed. And while you see our unemployment levels at a state level dropping down into the upper 6-point-whatever percentage rate, our underemployment is most of that difference that went from the double-digit unemployments now down to the high sixes. And then the other thing we're finding out, too, is that people in our district, in most of rural Snohomish and Skagit County, are making but a fraction of what they were making before, averaging approximately two-thirds of what their salaries were prior to 2008. We've also seen, as you know, you're dealing with it here in the city, all the homes that were lost, people foreclosed on, all those types of challenges amongst us as well, not to mention the businesses. Drive down Main Street, go back to pre-2008, how many of those businesses were empty? Not many compared to today. And so we've got a very fragile recovery at best that's going on in Washington State. And when it comes to the social economic challenge with respect to transportation, it's not as if people within our district don't understand that there's a problem that they want to solve. But because of the economic challenges and social challenges they're dealing with right now, they're saying to me, they're saying, I want this, but right now I just can't afford this. We're seeing the same phenomenon happen in many of our schools. Now, it's changed a little bit in the last couple years. But we in the 39th District, which has got most of Skagit and Snohomish County, we saw levies failing over and over again. And it was not because the people didn't want their schools improved. It was because they were having a challenge with how do I pay for it? I can't afford it right now. I can barely make my house payment. Maybe I lost my home. I don't have a job. Those are the challenges that we're dealing with, not just here in the 39th District, but geographically speaking, most of Washington by far. Almost all of eastern Washington except for the greater Spokane area, and then you start getting down into the 8th Legislative District, which is and the 9th Legislative District, which is kind of that Tri-Cities up into Yakima and Walla Walla area. They've actually done very, very well. They were only, during the worst of times, they were only experiencing less than 4% unemployment. And so kind of an anomaly compared to the rest of the state of Washington. but most of the state we're finding, and there was actually some polling that was done statewide, we found essentially two legislative districts out of the 49 that could pass a gas tax. Two. There's 15 districts, by the way, in the city limits of Seattle. Even Seattle and most of their districts couldn't pass a gas tax. And so when it comes to dealing with some of our transportation challenges that we're dealing with right now, the appetite is just not there. And while we were struggling last year, the year before, and even the first part of this year on putting together a transportation package, when the governor came out with his agreement in, was it the end of last year, I want to say it was about December of last year, with the West Coast governors in Canada on the carbon fuel standards, mm-hmm. all of a sudden our emails and phones started to light up. We had a lot of groups that were in favor of putting together a transportation package, who were sponsoring putting together a transportation package, that said, time out, this changes everything. The unknown factor with respect to what that really means, we know based on all the experts that have looked at it, not only from those outside of Olympia, but those even within Olympia, even within the governor's own office, is that it's estimated it'll be at least a dollar a gallon. And now remember, this is not just on gasoline and diesel. This is on any carbon-emitting fuel. Your heating bills, electrical bills, all those, most of that stuff is generated by some type of a fuel that emits carbon. And that's what's not being talked about here. You've got a group of folks out there that are saying, this is just going to hurt the guys that are driving down the roads. That's not true. It's going to hurt all levels of manufacturing. It's going to hurt all levels of utilities. PUD, PSE, the major utilities that take care of us here in the county, your rates are going to go way up if you start adding a dollar a gallon tax to those types of fuels. And so we've got to make sure that we really understand completely what it is that we're dealing with here before we start getting behind and supporting these things, thinking it's only going to be somebody besides ourselves that's affected by this, when in reality it's going to be everybody. Your food prices will go up. Every product that you get here will go up. Shipping prices will go through the roof because you're going to see an average increase just in shipping costs of about 30%. That's what this really means. The Trucking Association, Washington State Trucking Association, the largest provider of shipping in the state, was all in on a transportation package until that handshake was made. Now they are totally against it. Much of the Association of Washington Business Groups have come out now who are promoting the package are totally against it until this is figured out. And so at a local level, those are the types of things that I think you need to really be wrestling with, talking to other officials about this, especially those that are promoting this, that you have a clear understanding of what it means to you all at the local level. Because, you know, here in Monroe, we have other ways of getting money for some of our transportation projects, like we've done here on the outskirts of, or actually here in town up in the Sultan area. We've gotten a lot of money as compared to what's really been the budget. We've got other ways of getting money funded, and I've worked, of course, with you on the Transportation Improvement Board and some of the other funding sources that we have. They're not actually earmarked in the overall budget, but the 39th District over the course of the last 4 years now has received more than twice as much money from the Transportation Improvement Board as compared to every other district in the state of Washington. And when I talked to the director of that, he said, you guys have got your local officials so cued in as to how this works, it's been very, very beneficial for us, even at a time when we're not seeing major dollars in the actual operating budget for transportation. We've actually been able to get a lot of resources into the district from other areas of the budget. You know, there's a number of challenges that we're dealing with down in Olympia, but as we've gone through and polled our district along with the rest of the state, but even in our own district, we've gone to hundreds of people around the state, hundreds of people in our own district. The number one issue in the 39th district is jobs in the economy. Number two issue is high taxes. Number three is high cost of health care. Number four is education, and number five is transportation. We've been doing an annual poll in the district for the last several years, and it has not changed since 2007, believe it or not. Actually, health care has come up a little bit because the cost of health care in the last 24 months especially has changed a lot. That's the only one that really changed for us. We saw that in education swap. The environment, which was also on there, is down at about 2 to 3%. Not that people aren't concerned about the environment, but when asked what their top priorities are, those are the priorities they give to us. Questions? Because I can sit here and talk all night.
Council, questions? Councilmember Cutback.
Thank you. Thank you for coming tonight.
Yeah.
I just had a question about the marijuana issue, and that, that's been a complicated issue and with us dealing with here. I think we took the appropriate steps, how we felt we needed to deal with it. One thing I had read in the paper, I think about a month ago in the Seattle Times, was that there was now possibly a lawsuit or that taxes might not be able to, the revenue might not be able to be collected taxing that because it's not federally supported or it's not compliant with federal law. So do you have any kind of update on that? That might change things for some people. A lot of people that came and spoke for us enacting some type of an ordinance in support of it brought up that economic argument quite a bit and said the city doesn't want to lose out on this tax revenue. So do you know anything about where that's going?
Well, the specifics of the actual lawsuit, and there's more than one, okay? Mm-hmm. The specifics of the actual lawsuits, I'm not privy to all the details mm-hmm. on those. What I can tell you, though, is that we knew going into this the fact that you've got the federal government, it's still illegal. Mm-hmm. And you've got the state government, where it's supposedly not. Of course, we are now seeing like Colorado and Alaska and other states that have kind of followed suit with us. But what's interesting about even, for example, Alaska decriminalized it. That was a super broad way of dealing with it. Every state that is either in the process or is moving forward is doing it in their own way. Because of that, and because of existing pieces of the legislation we have here in Washington State and how it compares with what's going on in Washington, D.C., each one has its own challenges, and there's lawsuits taking place in every single state that this is going on. It's an opportunity in some cases for those who like, sorry, any attorneys in the room, but who like suing, with respect to that kind of stuff. But there is, well, but it's a reality of the culture that we live in, is some people are just looking for some low-hanging fruit to take advantage of those situations. On the other hand, you've got a lot of other interest groups out there that fought against the legalization of marijuana and have for years. But then you've also got states that have fought for it. And so you're always going to have battles like that going on. Now, based on the outcomes, we're all watching. At a legislative level, you know, what we do is we write legislation yet to be interpreted by the law. And, you know, until one of those things go to court, we're not quite sure how it's going to be interpreted. But yes, we are watching it. We knew that there was lawsuits pending this last legislative session. The fact that they could not come up with a deal for several different reasons, but the main reason had to deal with the local funding aspect, when it came to law enforcement, first responders dealing with the realities of what this is going to mean to our culture, it died. And so it's going to be something that I think, even if we had passed a piece of legislation this year, I'm sure, based on the fact that you've still got federal and state laws that are, clashing with each other, there's going to be lawsuits for years to come. Mm-hmm. But I would definitely keep an eye on it, because it's going to affect what you all decide to do at the local level. And you're not alone. There's a lot of other cities that have kind of taken the same tack that you all have. And even in our own legislative district, like I said earlier, we got about a dozen cities that overlap into the 39th district. And many of them are like yourselves, kind of watching and waiting to see what happens. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. You mentioned that, to switch to transportation, you mentioned that Highway 2 isn't on that list. What is the criteria to get on that list?
Oh, well, let me back up a moment. There was, at one point, the bypass was on the list, and I would love to talk about the bypass.
We've talked a little bit about it.
The bypass, the 522, Highway 2 bypass, whatever you want to call it, was even on the list in 2013. Mm-hmm. The problem was, now granted, the budget didn't pass. The transportation budget did not pass. I should say the new revenue package did not pass. But when they came before me, I'm the senior member up until last year. I'm the senior member on the Transportation Committee. I've been on there since 2003. And so as I was going through the line items on there, I was like, hey, there's the Highway 2 bypass. And then they have a dollar amount and a description of the project, which, by the way, the description of the project has not changed in about 4 or 5 years. I was actually here, I think it was 4 years ago, and the chamber and the city were talking about the Highway 2 bypass. Mm-hmm. And at the time, DOT had a representative here, and the price tag attached to this bypass, which is essentially a two-lane extension of 522, heading north, going about a half a mile to a roundabout mm-hmm. up on the hill up here. At the time, the price tag was just over $15 million. Okay? Last year, the exact same project was $46 million. Now, let's stop and think about that for a minute, because we've all been driving the 522 corridor. How many of you can tell me what the price tag is on the 522 project, because there's a sign with a cheat sheet down on the, you know, on the other, on the Woodinville end here. $73 million for five bridges, including one over a river, blasting of a mountain, or Lord's Hill, and a four-lane divided highway for $73 million. It did, the $46 million does not pass the straight face test, or the smell test, or any other litmus test you want to give it. And so I asked the question, I said, I want to see a breakdown of the project. That question was asked of Department of Transportation. They decided to remove the project from the list because they couldn't give us a breakdown of the project. And it was taken off the list.
So they have the ability to just put and take things off the list.
Based on interest and lack of being challenged. Yeah. So when it comes to some of the other projects along the way, you know, maybe it's just the fact that I don't just pass things without understanding them. But we have scrutinized the costs of many of these projects over the years, and when the DOT can't come back to you with a breakdown of a project like that that passes any smell test, I mean, essentially what you're talking about, it would have been $46 million, just so that you know, would be in the neighborhood of what it's costing us per foot to build a floating bridge. One lane. I mean, it's way over the top. Okay. So accountability is a big issue, and that's one of the issues that we do have with the Department of Transportation. Big Bertha was in trouble from day one because we, for 2 years, argued over who was going to pick up the cost overruns, and it was never settled before we broke ground. The floating bridge never should have been designed by the Department of Transportation engineers. They're brilliant people, they're very experienced, they're experts at what they know how to do. The floating bridge was not a project anybody in the organization had ever designed before. Should have been designed by an expert designing that kind of stuff. My personal background, professional background, is in commercial concrete. Thousands of projects all over the West Coast and even overseas. And when I took a look, and I'm not an engineer, but when I took a look at that plan and how they had designed it, I asked at the time Paula Hammond, who was an engineer for the company, for DOT, and was then acting Secretary of Transportation, who in the world designed this tension cable system for these pontoons the way they did? And she said to me, and I quote in front of other people, I was scared to give this presentation in front of the House Transportation Committee because you're on the committee and I know you actually know what this stuff is. And now we're trying to fix something that never should have been designed the way it was designed. It's costing the taxpayers of hundreds of millions of dollars in repairs to projects and putting off of, you know, breakdowns and things like that, because we have this insatiable appetite to build things without finalizing how the costs or cost overruns are going to work. Why are we, and this is without exception, in Washington State, being charged 1.5 to 2 times more to build the exact same type of project than every single state in the country, with no exception? No exception. There's a problem within how we do Washington State transportation, and we've got to solve that problem. I'm going to be I've got a nationwide meeting with legislators I'm going to next month. I was at one last summer with legislators from all 50 states. We on transportation are the laughingstock of the country, and I kid you not, they are like, you guys get so little for as much as you spend, and what you guys have to go through to build anything in Washington State is way over the top. 3 years ago now, Paula Hammond, who was the Secretary of Transportation, testified in front of the House Transportation Committee, and she said, and you can get this on TVW, you can get it, it's in the archives, that the state legislature and our state agencies are making it cost prohibitive for us to build transportation projects in the state of Washington. That came from the Secretary of the Department of Transportation, appointed by, at the time, Governor Greg Warren, essentially saying that we are making it impossible for us to build stuff in Washington State. We must reform the system. And that's why we have taken a hard line on we can no longer continue to build things like we build things in Washington State. It's costing the taxpayers, even if it didn't break, way more than it costs anywhere else in the country. But with the problems that we have, we continue to, you know, have, we've got to make some reforms and install measures of accountability in our system before we, or, you know, before the public, frankly, is going to be paying us to do these projects in the future. Don't call me Mr. Doom and Gloom. I'm just here to answer your questions.
Councilmember Gamble.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I appreciate the update.
Yeah.
Frankness. You know, one thing I didn't hear in there that I was wondering to get a pulse from is we've had $15 an hour in SeaTac, $15 an hour downtown Seattle. We talked about cost of goods around the transportation. What's been the scuttlebutt in the Capitol or from a statewide perspective? Has there been, I haven't seen, I may be missing, in regard to a statewide.
Minimum wage issue.
Yes, correct.
It was an issue that was talked about some, and people, I think, kind of gave in to the fact that Seattle was going to do something, and they wanted to see what happened in Seattle. And so as a legislative body and even as the governor, you know, while there was a lot of talk about it, and at the time they weren't going the full $15 an hour, they were talking about something closer to $12 an hour. But they wanted to see what happens in Seattle. And they're, you know, Seattle is known for kind of, you know, leading the charge on many issues. And I think what we're probably going to see based on the outcome of what's going on in Seattle, time's going to tell, first of all, what really happens in Seattle. There's a lot of other cities, including Bellevue, that are thrilled that it passed.
Right.
Because they're now estimating that a lot of those businesses are going to move across the lake outside of the Seattle metropolitan area into the neighboring cities. And actually, that's already, if you talk to the chambers, that's already happening. A lot of businesses are already planning their exodus, so to speak, from the city. And so long term, it's going to be interesting to see how it really affects Seattle. One of the things, though, I do believe we need to take into consideration that nobody ever wants to talk about when it comes to minimum wage is the inflationary factor. I had an interesting conversation with some of the restaurateurs. There's almost a 250,000 people in Washington State that are employed by restaurants. I think it's 218 to 220,000 people actually work for restaurants. Everything from, you know, there's a lot of restaurants here in Monroe. There's a lot of people there, but that's a big number of people. And of course, we are one of the only a couple states that don't deal with the when it comes to your tips. If you tip on a credit card, it's kept track of. If you tip in cash, it's supposed to be recorded, but in most cases, it's not recorded. If you talk to the restaurant folks when it comes to their servers, in most cases in restaurants, the servers make more money than the chefs cooking the food. It's a statewide issue. But one of the other issues is, let's talk about fast food for a second. Your Big Mac meal, which I'm not pushing the Big Mac meal, okay, cholesterol, you know, all that stuff. But just using that as an example, right now is about $6 for a Big Mac meal. Just raising the minimum wage to $12 an hour, it's estimated that same Big Mac meal is going to be just under $8.50. That's the inflationary factor, because it's not just the person who works there at McDonald's. It's everybody who grew the food, raised the food, harvested the food, processed the food, shipped the food, and the list just, it starts at the very beginning, all the way through to actually serving it to the customer. There was actually a study that was done by the fast food industry, and they said it's going to be in the low to mid $8 for that exact same meal, just raising it to $12 an hour. And so this is an inflationary factor that while it feels good that you might be making more money, the question is, are you better off in what you're able to afford down the road? And that's something that the economic impact of the minimum wage really has not been addressed. And my concern is that what we're doing is, there's groups of people out there that are pushing on something that really don't understand what the ultimate impact is going to be for us down the road. And that's something that I believe we've not done a good job of at this point, of being able to explain out there. So we actually do have folks that are looking into the economic impact right now and working with industries around the state of Washington. The other thing, too, is the second largest industry in the state of Washington is agriculture. Washington State is the most trade-dependent state in the United States. And our second largest industry being agriculture, which is about 250,000 people that are involved in the agriculture industry, is also one of the largest percentages of people that make minimum wage. agriculture is a commodities market. We compete not only with states around us, but we compete with, you know, countries around the world that are growing the exact same products in their countries or states that we are. We're already about $2 an hour more than Idaho. Idaho and Washington competing just on the potato commodities market puts us at an unfair advantage. And so the agriculture industry, it's estimated if we were to pass a minimum wage increase in Washington state, would decimate the agriculture industry. And so when we talk about the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of jobs that are at stake with respect to raising the minimum wage, you have to have a clearer understanding as to what the economic impacts are of different products that are available in our state and that we're competing with other states and other countries on. And there again is something that has to be talked about before you just make somebody feel good by giving them a $12, you know, minimum wage, and then you can't even afford to buy a burger, let alone a head of lettuce, because the commodities market and the inflationary factor puts you out of that marketplace.
Anything else, Councilmember?
Thanks.
Jeff, Jim, Jeffrey, come on.
Councilmember, well,
my favorite part, actually. I'd rather interact with you. So.
Councilmember Camp.
Thank you. Thanks again for coming by.
Yeah.
It was great seeing the last discussion with PCOs. So I heard this. You mentioned something there about public records and the possibility of doing something, since it uses a malicious tool against some city governments, some of the local ones. I was wondering if you could speak to that a bit.
Yeah, the public records request issue, Freedom of Information Act, has changed a lot since its inception. I want to say it was in the mid-1970s, something like that, when it was first put into play. I could be wrong.
Sounds about right.
Back then, I still remember typing on an IBM Selectric with triplicate carbon paper. Today, communications has changed dramatically, and I'm looking around here, you're all on your laptops. And if you're even communicating with each other while your council meetings are going on, you couldn't do that back then. The communications request today is literally thousands and thousands and thousands of computer pages, potentially per person, per act, per request. And when you've got a council the size of yours just communicating, take all your hours of communiques on your computer and then talk about what the costs are with respect to having an attorney go through all that stuff and find out what is really valid with respect to a certain case or whatever, you know, whatever your request is. The costs that are being put upon our local governments especially, but even at our state agencies and at a state level, has risen to a level that can't be ignored. And when we're seeing, you know, even small communities that are seeing hundreds of thousands of dollars in costs with respect to how this works, we've got to start taking a look at how this really works. And so does there need to be some changes to that? Well, first of all, you need to know I'm a huge supporter of public access. I'm a huge supporter of making sure the public knows what their public officials are doing. And so I'm not one of those that's saying, no, you know, we're going to shut this thing down. What I am saying, though, is that we've got to be a little bit more reasonable somehow. And I don't know the answer to this. We've got to be a little bit more reasonable as to how those requests work with respect to, all the transmissions, especially electronic, which are the bigger problem we're dealing with right now. We've got to have when we've got auditors and spending hundreds and thousands of hours reviewing documents and computers to find out, because of one request, whether or not it's really even something important for or required to give. And so it's not like the old days going through your file cabinets in the back where you could have, like, the IRS comes in and just starts going through your files. That's not how this works anymore. It's every single one of your laptops having somebody go through it, every single computer in the whole building having somebody go through it, and every single file you've got, somebody going through that. All of a sudden, you've got hundreds and thousands of hours that you've got to pay somebody to go through those records. And so it's changed a lot, and that is what we're dealing with here. It's very, very different and far more costly than it was, you know, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, because of how communications have changed. The other thing, too, is your phones. Your phones are all part of that. We saw what happened just a couple years ago with Snohomish County. They had some cases that were going on that the State Patrol was having to go through, and the thousands of hours of going through all the stuff just on a single case that was all computer generated was just an exorbitant cost. So we've got to take a look at how we do that most recently.
Thank you.
Councilmember Rasmussen, you want to say anything?
Got nothing. Thanks for coming.
Mayor?
Thank you very much for coming. We used to do a breakfast when I was on council some time ago, and I think it's valuable having our legislators, the people that represent us, coming and talking, whether it's at a breakfast or in this sort of forum. And so I thank you very much for standing there for a half hour and talking and responding to our questions. I guess I'm just going to make a couple of asks. We when we came down to Olympia during the legislative lobby days for the Association of Washington Cities, we made a couple of asks. One was to give an out for marijuana so that we could not be part of that if we wanted to. I think the council would still be of that mind, and in fact we opted, while allowing for it in our zoning, to prohibit the issuance of marijuana business licenses. So that's one thing that the city continues to stand by. The other thing we talked about, just some really simple things. Being able to extend the road that is on the east side of Galaxy so that we can, what is it again?
191st.
Up the hill.
Yep.
The hill, yeah. That goes through the right-of-way that you were just referring to with the Highway 2 bypass. Certainly, if the state doesn't plan on doing anything with it anytime soon, it would be valuable for us to be able to make that connection for both circulation as well as for safety reasons. The neighborhood that is back there has only one means of ingress and egress today. And we've had a couple situations where there has been a fire at the end of Rainier View Drive all the way in back. And I remember hearing when I was doorbelling that area last year that that a corner house there actually burned down.
The first house in on the left.
Yeah, the first house in on the left.
Fire access.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and people were locked out of their neighborhood or locked in their neighborhood for a couple or a few hours several hours. So, you know, having DOT work with us to do the engineering necessary so that we can put in a road up there, include that in our transportation plans would be of great value for us. Just real simple. I, as well as I'm sure the rest of council, really appreciate the TIB funds that have come to our city to allow for things like the extension of Turney Place. And also, you mentioned earlier tonight helping out with repaving roads like Frylands. We also have received some grants from the Department of Ecology related to stormwater improvements, and we've used that money to both do those stormwater improvements but also to improve the cross sections of our downtown. We appreciate all that. Some of the things that I see around town that we seem to be treated a little bit differently than some of the towns to the south, again, real simple things, but parts of Lewis Street, we don't have curbs. It appears that pavement has been put over the road again and again and again to the point where there are some places where the curbs are maybe like this. And the results to that, first, it doesn't look good. It's not aesthetically pleasing. But you also have functional issues. You have people that will parallel park in the downtown and not realize they've gone over the curb and might park on the sidewalk in part. You also have issues with drainage where water will just cover the sidewalk, and that's not a good condition. But when the water then dries, all that silt and everything stays right there in front of people's houses and whatnot along Lewis Street. So that's a concern. And in fact, one of the things that we had happen with the recent ADA improvements on Lewis Street is that because they opted not to take care of the stormwater, is that a couple of those ADA access points on the corners, the water in a rainstorm that occurred after that actually ponded a couple inches across that ADA access. So, you know, when I go to Duval, when I go to Carnation, I see very nice cross sections, and whether we need to come forward with the delta in the cost or if DOT just needs to treat us like everybody else and grind down the asphalt, you know, we are a city that does affect aesthetics. It affects health, and it affects the environment, and we'd like to have those things done correctly here in town. The bypass, I think, is important. We do want to see that on the plan. We do appreciate the things that have occurred here, the improvements with the flyover with 522. There have been improvements on 522 that we appreciate, so thank you.
Voted for that in 2003.
Well, thank you.
It only took until 2011 to start the project.
Took a long time, and it's still being built. And I work in Everett, and we look to the east side a lot. I thank you for the improvements on Bickford. The flyover there has helped improve the traffic condition on Highway 2. So all those improvements, thank you, and we'd like to see those continue. Lastly, I'm just going to give a plug for our schools. I know that there is a Supreme Court decision and a need to place our schools at much higher priority than they have been in the past. So I would encourage you and the legislature to listen to our school district. I'm sure they come forward and talk about their concerns, and I'm not going to pretend to know what all those concerns are because I'm not a school board member, but our schools, they teach our children. Our children are our future. I know it sounds cliche, but for us to be competitive internationally, we need to have kids that are skilled in vocations, as well as very well trained for the, you know, for accounting and policy development and all the engineering and all those other sorts of professions as well. So, I guess those are my only comments. And
can I make a couple comments?
Yes, sir.
You got some, because I got some homework now for you.
Okay. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
We'll start with your, when it comes to 191st, going up the hill, one of the things that will be helpful for us is if you can work with your local fire department and also with the police department here to find out, it'd be nice to have what the egress issues are up there. In other words, how many people are trapped back in there in a case like the fire that you were talking about earlier.
Okay.
Because there could be some emergency type funding that we might be able to deal with respect to things like that on egress issues. We have run into that in the past. So if you can get us any of the first responder help would be very helpful to us. I'm assuming within your own archives, you know how many people are up there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you moved your tax rolls, men, women, and children, how many cars a day, all that kind of stuff, so that we have an idea what we're dealing with there.
Okay.
And I may have some other ideas of some different sources, too, to go through on that.
Okay.
With the curb issue, you were talking about ecology and the grants that were given to you before. One of the things, though, that you might want to talk to ecology about is ecology, because of the stormwater aspect of it, it could qualify as an ecology grant project.
Okay.
The curbs. Now, whether that is the grinding of existing asphalt to re-expose the curbs, mm-hmm. or whether it's actually raising the curbs and sidewalks, that's something that would have to be engineered.
Okay.
And how that all would work with your slopes and everything else. But because of the stormwater issue, curbs is a huge issue with respect to ecology. And if the DOT has not been, if they've just been doing chip seal projects or overlay projects in that section of Lewis Street right there and eliminating the curbs, I don't even know if they're aware. If ecology is not aware of it, they will actually help in the prioritization and in the pushing of, or manipulating, whatever word you decide to use,
okay.
with respect to how those projects are done in the future, okay, and
okay.
how much more help we can get from DOT on that. Transportation, we were talking about the maintenance aspect of it kind of on the heels of this curb project, too.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other reasons why there was a project with the budget, transportation budget in 2013, was the fact that the maintenance and operation portion of the $12 billion transportation budget that was being proposed was $1 billion. Actually, it was less than that. It was less than $900 million for 12 years for the whole state. And we were talking about this earlier. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is a lot.
That comes out to about $85 million a year, okay, for 12 years. $85 million, just to give you something that's tangible, well, you saw how much it's costing for 522, $73 million for that one section right there. $85 million is approximately 200 miles of chip seal.
Per year.
Chip seals when they dump down the asphalt and press some gravel into it. That's 200 miles of that for the whole state. The state's more than 200 miles long, okay, both directions. And that's all that was in the entire maintenance and operation budget for the whole state was $85 million a year. Bridges that need to be repaired, asphalt and potholes and all kinds of problems that we've got, just maintaining what we've currently got, was nowhere close to the number it needs to be. It's no different than you building a building or a home that you can't afford the utility bills on. If we're going to just continue to build stuff and not budget to maintain what we've got, we're going to have problems like bridges and other roads and failures in our transportation system. We have to take seriously, no different than you, you've got a very large percentage of your budget is maintaining everything in this town that you're supposed to maintain. That was nowhere close to what that budget would be. And in comparison, we had almost dollar for dollar the same amount of money we were going to spend on building new bike paths and pedestrian lanes in the state of Washington. Just give you something to think about there. You know, I'm all for biking and pedding, but if we're going to spend $1 billion on that stuff and we're going to spend the same amount of money to maintain everything in the system, it just doesn't work. And so we've got to get real, because we are decades behind in our maintenance and operation budgets. We've had the same challenges within our school systems. We've got the same challenges in all our municipalities. We've got it in transportation. We've got to take that seriously. And when it comes to school funding, thank you for bringing that one up. I actually ran the very first Fund Education First bill in the history of the state in 2006, and it took the McCleary court decision to get a hearing on my bill. And so it's been a priority of us, making sure that not only are we funding it properly, but also that we're reforming education properly, because even the McCleary decision, state Supreme Court said, money alone is not going to solve this problem. We've got reforms to the system that we need to take seriously so that the money goes into the right places. And that's where the debate is. The largest new input of money into our education system was made last year. 18% increase. We had not seen more than 3 or 4% increases since I'd been there. We put in 18% new money. $1.5 plus billion went into our K-12 education system in 2013. By far the largest input we've seen in decades. And so do we have a ways to go? Absolutely, we've got a ways to go. But we also have some reforms that have to go with that. We cannot have our local school boards being dictated to how the money is going to be spent that we give to them by all the local stuff that's going on. If the state's going to give the money, the state has to create a sideboard so that all of our local school boards are empowered and have the flexibility to work with those funds that have been given to them, so that they're not going to get run over by, you know, whatever is going on at the local level. And some school boards are a lot stronger than other ones are around the state. We've got a lot of very, very rural school boards that are being challenged. And so we've got to have reforms in place to make sure that those dollars get into the classroom, period. Because a very small percentage of our money today, it was less than 40% of our money, was actually making it to the classroom. And if we're going to get the best education system for our kids, we've got to make sure more of that money is getting into the classroom. The classroom includes the building, the teachers, the staff at the school, the transportation of the school. And when you've got less than 40% of your budget is doing that, you've got a problem with your education system. We've got to turn that around so more money is actually getting into our local schools and not getting absorbed up in a bunch of paperwork and other stuff that we lose money on in our education system. So, yes, thank you for bringing that up. It's a huge priority of ours. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for your service.
Thanks.
So we're going to go ahead and take a recess until 10 till. That's about 2 minutes. Oh, I need a quorum. All right, we're back in session. The next item that we have on the agenda is a proclamation. It's for Amateur Radio Week. What I've done is we've got a hyperlink there for the proclamation, and rather reading it fully into the record. We have Amateur Radio Field Day, which is a 24-hour exercise that's taking place to demonstrate radio amateur operator skills and readiness. That'll be on June 28th. If anybody, and there isn't somebody here to receive this from an outside organization today, so I'm going to go ahead and you've got that in the record so that you can see that if you like. We're going to go ahead and move on now to comments from citizens. This is a time set aside for members of the audience to speak to the City Council on any issue related to the City of Monroe, except any quasi-judicial matter subject to a public hearing. We do have a sign-in sheet, and it is right here. Barbara Bell, please come forward and state your name and address for the record.
Barbara Bell,
Yes, please.
My name is Barbara Bell. I live at 6626 203rd Avenue Southeast, Snohomish, Washington, 98290.
Thank you.
As I said, my name is Barbara Bell. I'm the District 2 Division A Governor for Toastmasters International. I am responsible for 7 area governors, over 35 clubs, and over 300 members stretching from the Canadian border down to South Everett, over to Whidbey Island, and out to Sultan. Today, I'm coming on behalf of Monroe Vocal Project, your local club that you may or may not know existed here. I've come to invite you to come to one of our meetings. Now, some of you may not know what Toastmasters is, and I can't say that I knew back in 2010 when I discovered it, actually got dragged into it, kicking and screaming. I didn't realize that the second most common phobia that people have is the fear of public speaking. What Toastmasters does for people is they provide an environment whereupon we empower individuals to excel in their public speaking skills, their communication skills, publicly and interpersonally. We also empower them to grow in their leadership skills. Now, back in 2010, I had lost my job due to regulatory changes with the state in the industry that I worked in. And I was shy. I didn't really feel like I was a good leader. And a friend of mine dragged me into Monroe Vocal Project. And I have to tell you that my first speech, I almost threw up. Really. I did. But in 2011, wouldn't you know it, I won the International Speech Contest. In 2011, I was nominated and elected Area 55 Governor. And today, I'm the Division A Governor. And I'm in charge of all these people and all these clubs. And the one that I want to focus on today is your club, Monroe Vocal Project. And I'd like to invite you all to come visit us. We meet Thursday evenings at 6 o'clock over at the Alfie's Pizza, and yes, I'll buy pizza, next to Staples on Highway 2. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Are there any other members of the public that would like to come forward to speak this evening? Anybody else? Okay, seeing none, we're going to go ahead and move on to our consent agenda. Council? Okay. Councilmember Cutterback?
I'll make a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
I have a first from Councilmember Cutterback, a second from Councilmember Rasmussen. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 All opposed, motion passes 4-0. Okay, we're going to move now on to new business. The first item on new business is AB 1403. This is approval of resolution number 013-2014, amending cost allocation plan for interfund fees. And I believe this would be Diane.
We have, with fund accounting, we have internal service funds that perform services for other funds, and they mm-hmm. charge fees. We also charge administrative services fees from the general fund. And this resolution is to amend our current cost allocation method of charging fees to a historical cost method rather than an estimated cost method. And so, it's recommended by the auditors. It's less labor intensive. Mm-hmm. It makes more sense as far as with an estimated system, you estimate and then you have to reconcile and pay back the money, and mm-hmm. it goes back and forth, and it's very confusing budget purpose for people managing the funds because they don't know if they can rely on certain money or not for future projects in the next year's budget. So, and this also, new method still maintains the reserve policy that council approved so that that stays intact. So we always have our reserves met. The city attorney has reviewed it. The local state auditors team has reviewed it. And the finance and HR committee, council committee, has reviewed it. So I'm hoping council will adopt it. Do you have any questions at all about the cost of it?
Councilmember Cutterback.
Thank you. Thank you, Diane. I know we've talked about this a couple times before. Mm-hmm. It's a two-year look back, so 2015 would use 2013 numbers.
Correct.
Is there any, I guess, is there any issues with that or problems using an old number? Is there any increases built in there? Because you know, costs do go up, employee costs, all that health care costs, right. All that does increase. So how does that even out or accounted for?
In the long run, it works. There may be some years where it's a little tight. If you're planning for something new, you can charge for that.
Okay.
But if you're expanding, you know, adding employees, you can add for that.
Okay.
It's it mainly, though, controls the cost so that it's a known. The costs are a known.
Yeah.
And they know how much money they have to work with.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
Councilmember Camp.
Thank you. I would like to move to approve resolution number 013/2014, amending the cost allocation plan for interfund fees.
Second.
First from Councilmember Camp. I have a second from Councilmember Cutterback. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? Motion passes 4-0. The next item on the agenda is AB 14084, Introduction of Permanent Sign Code Regulations. Paul.
Okay, we adopted interim regulations way back in April of 2013. It's been a little over a year. And we're now at a point where we're ready to move ahead with permanent regulations. We've been tweaking these, refining them, trying to fix a number of things over the last few months. I'll go through some of these things very quickly, but we did meet with the commission on the 9th. A week ago, and public hearing. We did not have any testimony. In fact, through the life of this code change, since we really got serious about it, we've had only one comment early on, and I had three minor comments from Dick Steemer at the SignCo, local sign company, on this latest round on a few things. For the most part, it's been customers have not expressed any particular problems with any of this. A lot of this has been done with staff and trying to clarify and fix some things that really weren't clear. But just very briefly, the changes that were made and adopted in the interim ranks really were a number of key points, like digital signs, which are not now really regulated, or they weren't before this new code. We'll allow those in general commercial, light industrial, and if you recall, it cannot be visible from Freiland's Boulevard if you put up a sign in the industrial park, and at 522 and Main Street. And I want to come back to that intersection in a bit. We offered the possibility for off-premise signs, like Galaxy Theater and maybe Walmart. May want to have some kind of an indicator out on Highway 2 that, hey, Walmart is this way. But we've clarified that some by saying that you have to be within a quarter mile straight line distance measurement of where that sign is to your property. put a limit on really how far they can go. But that essentially takes in virtually every eligible property in the logical places. That's kind of an example of a minor thing that really helps clear up how you go about applying for something like that. Sandwich signs, we are allowing them only in downtown, West Main, some public zones, and they can be used as temporary signs in virtually any zone. But that means that they're coming out of general commercial in North Kelsey, they're coming out of light industrial. I think we'll get some pretty good pushback on that when the time mm-hmm. comes to start enforcing. The idea being there to really to mm-hmm. clean up the clutter. They're really self-defeating in the way that they're happening now. And just cleaning up a number of different things. So on this latest round, in the last few months, what we concentrated on were some things that were brought up by staff, by the few comments we had, by conversations and with the Planning Commission, which included these several things here. Trying to set some things like fixing the sign maximum allowed in certain places, cleaning up the just what does it mean that I can't put up a sign for a business related, like a daycare or something like that, in a residential zone. Church, right now a church sign is actually illegal, or was illegal, in a residential zone. Some things like that. We spent some time on how you deal with the number of signs on a building. We tweaked definitions, and if you've been through the material, you see where we've come up with some new definitions on where signs are allowed and how you calculate the area. But more importantly, you can have one sign on your primary facade, which is typically where the front door is, and you can have one sign on your secondary facade, which is, say, the side of a corner building or side of the building that faces a parking lot, but that can only be 3/4 the size of the primary sign. So we've assigned some limits on things, both number and size of some of those signs. Addressing things like, you know, nonprofit community event type of things. I mentioned the distance for off premise. The other part of that is that we included a requirement that there be at least 3 off premise or off-site businesses advertising on a off-premise sign. You can't put up just one. You've got to make it worth their while and have at least 3. Walmart, Galaxy, and Five Guys, for example. And those are monument signs. They're like round signs. Downtown, we're allowing freestanding signs, say on Main Street or Lewis. That would be almost like a traffic sign, a directory sign for businesses that are off Lewis or off of Main. And in the industrial park, Long Fridays, we're allowing for a monument sign for off-premise, but again with 3 tenants or 3 businesses. What else? We want signs to be prepared by a professional or basically not handwritten. This is for businesses, but we wrote in exceptions for things like nonprofits or community events. You know, we think of things like decorating windows for homecoming mm-hmm. or decorating windows for holidays, that sort of thing. Those sort of things are accepted. But putting out an A-board and taking a paintbrush and handwriting for business is just not acceptable. And just a whole bunch of other minor clarifications. But I wanted to touch back on any questions at this point or anything that has come up as you've gone through this?
Council, any questions? So we've got 3. 2. Okay. Councilmember Camp.
Thank you.
And then Councilmember Cutaback. Go ahead.
I was just curious. So when you mentioned about the nonprofits, essentially those are just temporary signs when you talk the handwritten.
Essentially, yes.
And are there any, at one point I believe there was an issue about having a sign for a business on a building that no longer contains the business? And is that being eliminated or you no longer can
it's
do
being,
that?
No, it's being included and expanded a bit. And a word on enforcement, as soon as this becomes effective, which would be late July, mm-hmm. we're going to start enforcement. We're gearing up to literally hit the streets and start a pretty massive enforcement program once this is adopted.
But you can have multiple business signs on a building. I guess I didn't understand that part of it. You could have more than one business sign, more than one business advertised on a building. Is that correct? Or is it just, is that three limit only for the monument signs?
It's a multi-tenant building. Then each tenant space would have the ability to put up one sign on their primary frontage, their front door.
Right, but the three sign issue is just for the monument signs.
Pardon me?
The three signs, Walmart, the example you gave.
The off-premise sign.
Off-premise sign.
Right.
That's the only one. Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
We wanted to, we took a number of three as a good starting point to justify the expense and usefulness of an on-premise sign.
Okay. Thank you.
Councilmember Cutterback.
So, Paul, let me clarify that. So an off-premise sign, can it only be a monument sign, or can you have a freestanding?
It, in the light industrial and general commercial North Kelsey Highway 2 areas, it can only be monument sign.
Okay.
What that consists is of the name of the business and an arrow. It's not advertising, it's just identification.
Well, and those are usually a monument sign and has a lower height than a freestanding sign.
It does.
So where are the freestanding off-premise signs allowed?
Freestanding is downtown. Since there's really no place for monument signage in a place like that, it would be a sign, almost like a traffic sign, in the right-of-way. That would, it would be a fairly small freestanding sign that would have, again, the name of the business, Abbey Antiques Arrow, since they're off of the main drag, Lewis and or Main.
Now, would those fit in with kind of the design or the downtown plan? There was a portion of that plan that talked about signage. Is this congruent with that, or is it in conflict with that?
No, it's not in conflict with that, and really what I'd really like to get this pretty well defined if we ever get to the wayfinding package that we've been talking about for a good while. And there, you know, whatever, whoever comes up first, and that may happen before we're into this whole wayfinding program with any specificity anyway, but we'll adhere to the, we'll follow the downtown design sign standards as well as our newly adopted sign design guidelines. So yes, it will be pretty carefully done.
And how tall are those? I mean, I can look in here, but how tall are the freestanding, off-premise downtown signs?
Oh, they would be like typical traffic sign height, like what, 8 feet?
So not tall.
No, not tall.
Okay. I just didn't, you know, I was envisioning this 35-foot downtown going, oh my goodness.
No.
Okay, so it's about 8 feet. Most of the off-premise, I see monuments. So I'm trying 10 feet.
Maximum height.
Okay. And then just a comment about the sandwich signs in the Frylands, the light industrial, because where I work is over there, and there seems to be a huge issue with the sandwich signs being out. So I foresee. Is that group aware that those sandwich signs, unless they're a temporary event, are going to be going away because they are littered throughout there? And I think enforcement is going to be difficult. And people are even, businesses are even putting it on other businesses' property, that frontage of Frylands. And I wonder if you've got no input from them on that issue of this sign code.
None.
Heard nothing from them. None. Which surprises me, because they've been seem to be pretty vocal about getting their signs out there and using those sandwich boards. So
it has been a year, but we did, about the time we were close to considering adopting the interim regs, we sent a postcard to every single licensed business in town. It doesn't cover every business, but we sent out, I forget how many, hundreds and hundreds of postcards. Didn't get a single get one response. But we've been toying with the idea of possibly doing that again. Frankly, I'm not sure it's worth the effort and the expense.
Well, and enforcement appears to be happening a little bit in there, where I've been told that some signs were taken by the city and it cost $40 to retrieve those signs.
Well, right now we have no teeth in terms of fines.
Chief is saying yes over there. So that has been going on.
I think there have been a couple cases where things have been picked up.
Okay.
But,
yeah.
I don't know if we have a pickup fee, but part of what we want to do is come back and actually implement some fines or ability to assess fines or fees to help us enforce this. Because right now there's not much in the way of teeth.
Well, so there's been a $40 retrieval, sign retrieval, that I've heard of that's been already out there, so I don't know. And Chief shaking his head, so obviously that's been happening. So there is some amount of teeth, because people are talking about not putting their signs back there because they don't want to pay the $40. I do have a concern about the enforcement aspect, and it's funny because I was just talking to a business owner tonight who works at Daymar. He's an employee at Daymar, and he was talking about how littered those signs are, and really that's going to be enforced. And so I know that was talked about by Councilmember William previously when we looked at this, as he was worried about putting an ordinance into effect that was going to have a real difficulty enforcing. And so I don't know how much thought or has been put into that enforcement act, because it's not just a one-shot go out and get the signs. No. It's a continual.
It's going to be constant.
Ongoing.
And the objective being, well, not the objective, the practice will be to be consistent throughout the city.
Sure.
We're not going to pick on one area or certain businesses versus others.
But just so we're aware that there is an enforcement going on right now and there is a charge to it. So, and then my last comment was really about the height, and I kind of argued this when we put the interim sign ordinance into effect, but I still have a little bit of a problem of the 35-foot, you know, height that we allow, you know, even on Highway 2, and there's been plenty of documentation saying that 35 feet is not necessary, and so I just, no comments are...
No comments, but the thing I wanted to revisit was the sign height at the 522
yeah,
at Main Street and at Highway 2. The 35-foot sign height in the general commercial, I think that's been that height for some time, well before this round of sign code. And I don't believe, I'm not sure there's any signs out there more than 30 feet. Safeway put up a sign a few months ago, and I think that was 28 feet, something like that.
So yeah, but we're allowing up to 35 when we don't even have a 30.
It's allowed.
Yeah.
And it's a matter of expense, too. As the higher you get, the more expensive and structure you need to hold that sign in place.
Right.
It probably doesn't pay very much after a certain point, but that's, you know, that's not our judgment call.
And then you were going to talk a little bit about the 522 Main Street and kind of the height there, because one says 35 and then the other is the limited highway that's the 45.
Right. When we adopted the interim originally, we had quite a bit of discussion at the commission level for these digital signs, and this was one of the main proponents of that was the Speedway Chevrolet. 35 versus 45 foot height, and we did end up reducing the size of the sign, the face, from 180 to 140 square feet, so it's what, like 10 by 14. The commission recommended on a very close vote to do 35 feet. When it came to council, there was a fair amount of discussion, and as I recall, a somewhat close vote for 45 feet. So the code now has the sign height for those two intersections, 522 at Main and Highway 2, as a 45-foot height. And there's pretty limited possibilities for where they can go up. But nonetheless, there's the potential for those to happen. In fact, someone was in maybe a week or two ago and picked up an application, and was told that that was intended to be for a digital sign on 522.
So I've got a couple of other folks also. Before we move on to other topics, let's go ahead and get them. Councilmember Gamble, and then we'll continue.
Actually, it was just a comment. If I recall, one of the requirements when we took that vote was that was the orientation of the sign at the 45-foot level. So it had to be. We had, you know, we were pretty much all in agreement when we originally approved the interim to be at 35. It was upon further testimony around the elevations compared to the road as it goes over Main Street that without a 45-foot height. Orientating it to 522, that actually it could potentially, I mean, you know, why put a sign up, or it could be, you know, a safety. If you're putting it up, it's better to have it at 45 feet. It can be viewed, you know, that sort of thing. If I remember correctly, and there's very specific on the orientation. There's only a couple locations that you could actually do it on either side of 522.
Right. It does have to be perpendicular.
Correct.
To 522, not
which is the basically the orientation of the sign, right? Mm-hmm. So. On that, and then the other the original reason why I hit the light because that's okay. The other thing is that I'm reading through this. So all the signs that are in North Kelsey, the banner signs that are in the ground, Five Guys, T-Mobile, public right of way.
Banners are limited to the face of the building of the business.
Because those have, and I guess the, you know, the no input that we've gotten for a year, we sent postcards to the local, because those are, you know, larger chains or franchises. We sent them to those as well, or is that just the Fryland? Because those have been permanent fixtures, whether it's Verizon or T-Mobile, or, I mean, those are kind of mainstays and all of the cities across, whether it's Kirk, I mean, anywhere you go, those are in the public right away. And when we had the grand opening for Five Guys, they were all the way down Kelsey there.
You're talking about the feather banners, right?
Yeah.
Oh, the flags?
No, I understand that. I mean, reading through it.
They would not be allowed.
They're not allowed.
they're
proliferating. I just have a hard time.
Banners are different than feather, which is why I was clarifying.
Does it? Well, yeah, it depends on where you are. They call them banners.
Right. That's why he was answering banner up against building, right. And you wouldn't put a feather sign up against buildings.
Vertical banners.
Right. The ones in the public right of way.
Right. Yes. And they should be in the public right of way in the first place. Mm-hmm. But, and we've been doing enforcement based on complaints or specific things, but not doing a blanket enforcement until we got it in place and then hit it hard. So there's going to be a lot of flags coming out on the ground. Vertical banners, but horizontal banners are limited to, you know, certain periods of time, and it's got to be on the building face.
Right. No, I'm not talking about those
fence. So there's going to be a lot of people that are going to have to be taking down some of their signage.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions, Councilmember? Okay, Councilmember Camp.
Thank you. There's one more point I wanted to question I wanted to ask. What about nonprofit sandwich boards?
Nonprofit or A board or sandwich boards are allowed in as temporary signs in all zones.
So if they go up for the day, for a day?
A day or for the only
day. Right, particular day of the week that I've been seeing.
Yeah, okay. Business can do the same. If they're having like a grand opening sale, right. They can put an A board sandwich sign for a certain period of time.
So the nonprofits are just treated the same way. There's no.
Right. Yeah.
I didn't see that in the. I'm sorry.
Why did you? That's how I don't see it either.
No, if you deal for a question just on that, is that I saw the nonprofit, but I didn't see anywhere in there, Paul, about businesses being able to use sandwich boards for a special event. It specifically says nonprofit, school, but I didn't see anything in there for private business. So if that is the intent, that's not written in the code.
In the temporary
correct.
Sign category?
I'll find it here in a second.
It's toward, I'll give you a page number.
48?
33. Your planner, Nelson.
Well, I'm thinking.
You have a section number.
Where it says temporary signs, all zones.
Yeah, page 3. Well, I've got a page 31.
That's
almost
chart.
To the end
There's
of the table. The last page of the table.
Oh, okay.
Temporary signs, which is for all zones. It allows sandwich signs for like a special event, for retail sale, mm-hmm. for
31. Where's that?
Garage sale, real estate signs. We're down here with a special event for government, schools, sports, farmers market, that sort of thing, and certainly and political.
There's the retail one.
So those are in all zones, but they are temporary.
Right. But temporary is not, I'm trying to say, if this is a weekly occurrence, it still remains a temporary sign.
Say again, please.
If they're putting a sandwich board up every Sunday.
That's a temporary
sign. That's a temporary sign. That was what I was asking.
Like, you know, the Rock Church may.
Right. That they put it up, and they put it up in a residential area near Fryland.
They put it on Fryland Boulevard, but.
So will that be restricted on Fridays?
I'm not going to be here on Sundays. In reality, no.
Okay.
But I think the pushback is going to be from places where we are simply banning
right.
sandwich or you know A boards as a regular sign for a business. They're supposed to be out there only when they're open for business, mm-hmm. and they take them in every night and they put them on the front. There's a lot of businesses that. Move their sign a few doors down,
mm-hmm.
like toward the corner. So there's going to be a lot of enforcement on that.
Okay. Anything else, Councilmember?
I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and continue with your presentation, and then we'll have other
questions. Well, that was really about it. I didn't want to touch on that 35 versus 45 foot height issue, since that was fairly controversial. Did I mention that the commission elected not to reconsider that 35 versus 45. They're thinking it wasn't the council made the decision, so we're going to let that stand. But you know, just bringing it back as an FYI for this council.
Council members, do you have any other questions?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Plan on coming back on July 8th for a first reading, so we'll go, you know, go through a lot of this again, and then adoption on the 15th, and it will be effective about a week before the current regulations expire. So, good time.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you.
Okay, the next item on the agenda is AB 14085, authorize the Mayor Pro Tem to sign an interlocal cooperation agreement renewal with Snohomish County for urban county requalification. I would ask that the city clerk note my recusal in the official minutes for the meeting. The reason for my recusal is that I am employed by the contracting party, Snohomish County. My position with the county is that of an employee, and my compensation consists entirely of fixed salary. There is no contingent component of my compensation package pursuant to RCW 42-23-040, and based upon my consultation with the attorney, I accordingly have and at most a remote interest in the agreement and am recusing myself from participation in this matter.
Thank you, Mayor. I will entertain a motion or discussion.
I'll make a motion to authorize the Mayor Pro Tem to sign the interlocal cooperation agreement amendment 1 with Snohomish County for urban county requalification with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Second.
Thank you. Received a motion from Councilmember Rasmussen, a second from Councilmember Cuddeback. Any discussion, please raise your hand. No discussion. We'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say aye. Passes 4-0. Mr. Mayor, welcome back.
Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, the next item that we have on the agenda is council member reports. And please note for the record that consistent with last week, we have three council members that are not here that are excused. We have Council Members Hanford, Council Member Davis, and Council Member Gehring. So we'll go ahead and go around. Council Member Campbell.
All right. So this last weekend was at our Sky Valley River Park there for Legends Baseball Tournament, 8U through 10U. The weather was threatening all weekend. Like I hear, I see Mr. Farrell over there doing a wipe across. The city did a great job. There was they looked like an army of ants out there swooping in with Diamond Dry and you know, trucks coming out of nowhere. They did a fantastic job. Got all the games in. There was, I think, two of the Monroe teams that placed, which was great. So they took home some hardware. But it was a great showcase of the park system. And then we had, you know, Rotary Field as well. So just nice job all the way around. And it was a good weekend for dads at the ballpark. Got some good pictures there. So tell them thank you. They did a great job.
Councilmember Camp.
Nothing to report.
Councilmember Rasmussen. Councilmember Cutaback.
What were you going to say?
Cutaback.
Nothing. Nothing. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, let's go out to department staff. Paul.
Just a reminder about the meeting tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at our place for the comp plan. Hope to see you all there.
And what was the time again? Start time?
7 o'clock.
Okay. Are there council members that are here? Are you going to be able to make it?
I'm gonna try to make it, yeah.
Okay.
I'm coaching the Sky Valley Girls All-Star team. I will not be able to.
Okay.
Okay. I'll be there.
You will be there. Okay. Thank you. Anything else? Yes.
Sorry. How long does it, do you think it would go? Is it an hour and a half, 8:30 or?
I'm going to guess maybe an hour and a half.
Okay. Thank you.
Elizabeth, City Clerk, this is a joint meeting. Do we need to have a quorum present of the City Council for this meeting?
This item was advertised as a joint meeting with a possible quorum of each of the bodies
possible.
There. It is not a special meeting in the terms of there is no action, as in final action to be taken. There is no discussion item specifically as action. It is just sort of the joint meeting. So that's how it was advertised, that there would be possibly a quorum in attendance.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Anything else, Paul? Okay. Diane, we'll leave you for last. Chief? Okay. Mike?
Thank you. This weekend's another busy weekend. We have another Legends tournament, and hopefully the weather will be a little bit better. But yes. Yeah, I am proud of our crew and the job they did, because that was a real challenge. They started with really soaking fields Saturday morning and also Sunday as well. So, yeah, I'm really proud of them. And also this weekend on Saturday is the Tri Monroe event. So you may, those of you on the west side or passing through, you might see the road closure notice signs. And that is, gosh, I think it's the fourth year we've had that event. And there's all of these Olympic age groups. There's about seven races. And if you have not had a chance to just check it out for like a half hour or an hour, it's really fun. It starts at 8 a.m. the races, and the last race, I think it ends about, say, 3:34 o'clock, and then there's an award at the end of that. So, fun stuff. That's all.
All right.
11U through 13U this weekend.
Okay. Brad.
Thank you to the Proclamation for Amateur Radio Week, and for those of you who want to be more sensitive to do, on the 28th, you come down to Sky River Park and watch people talk on the radio. So we'll be starting at 11 a.m. Join the wonderful world of amateur radio. We can let you talk if you want.
Okay. Anything else?
No, sir. That's all.
How is the roundabout coming at Chain Lake and Kelsey?
It's coming along. There's no pavement on the intersection anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see there's big lower parts of the road on the right and the left. So be so careful as you drive through there. And so it's coming along.
Okay.
And they're also giving out toll free.
Okay.
If you haven't noticed that yet.
All right. Thank you. Diane.
For your information,
information, you were each given a copy of a memo from myself to the mayor regarding mitigation exceptions, mitigation fee exceptions in the code, and it lays out how the code stands right now, and the Public Works Director is working on a proposed amendment that will be discussed later on to change the code so that it's more controllable, the dollar amount, and we're able to budget ahead of time and able to control how much how many dollars the city spends on exceptions. By state law, the city is required to make up the difference and pay the exception fee. And also regarding that is a breakdown of the fees so far paid by the city for the House of Family Village. And for the remainder of the fee, we did a budget amendment for some of them, and for the remainder of them, we should use unexpended line items in the general fund to cover those fees that we have to, that are remaining to be paid.
So I just want to point out, if you take a look at page 2, that's the summary of the financial, of the fiscal impacts. The goal here is to use the under expenditure that I directed earlier this year, plus, so we've already talked about the under expenditure with the economic development manager position, with the park. Remember, we had a park maintenance employee, FTE, that we decided to remain vacant, decided to keep vacant, and one other item that we decided to not fund. But in addition to that, in order to make up the additional fees here, there's $20,000 from the Economic Development Department's budget for professional fees. There's $20,000 from downtown signage. And is that downtown signage, is that the wayfinding study?
Yeah.
Okay. And there's also the GIS intern for $10,000. And was that out of engineering or was that out of economic? That's what I thought. Okay. So with these taken here, the under expenditure that that we set up, that I set into motion earlier this year is now expended, and that means that if there are any other fiscal issues that come up later this year, that we're looking at the $350,000, if I remember, the was it 350 roughly? About $400,000 in council contingency that we would need to look at in doing a budget amendment. So I just want to be clear with that. Now, there's still the $2.1 million of emergency reserve,
yes.
And so those funds are still there. But if any council members have any concerns about using the under expenditures that are identified in this memo, please let me know. Any concerns?
I have a question.
Yes, Councilmember Cutaback.
So I just have a question because the RCW states that basically we may provide an exemption in our code. Does our code say we shall or we have to, or does it give us flexibility as it's written now? Because I don't see the exact code.
It says shall on all of them except for one.
Which one is it?
School for low-income housing.
One of them is at the council's
discretion,
basically on an ad hoc basis. And that is, as I read the state law, an area where the council does have some discretion in formatting how your local exemptions are formatted. You can't be arbitrary,
uh-huh.
But you do have some discretion in framing how your process works, what criteria you establish, as long as the ultimate end user is one that falls within that broad public purpose definition. You have some latitude there.
Yeah, the one for school, you have some discretion. The rest were all shalls.
And how much is the total for schools on this total, on all of these homes that are here?
Oh, the school one is there, isn't it? $115,000?
Yeah, $115,296.
So my question about that then is if there's some discretion on the school impact fees, does that need to come to council to get formally approved? Have we already done that?
Okay, Brad, did you?
There's two exemptions for school fees. One is for low-income housing and one is for transitional housing.
Okay.
The low-income housing is the one that was for council discretion. The
transitional
housing wasn't.
That was a shall?
And that's a shall, yeah.
Okay, and this project is considered transitional, not low income?
Yeah. No, it's both, but it is transitional also for the ones that were granted the exemption.
Okay. So the 24 units are considered transitional and not low income?
Right. Well, they're also low income, but they're doing the transitional.
So just a quick point, all 47 units are categorized as very low income units. Some of those are transitional. About half, but they're all very low.
Yeah, no, I mean, but if the distinction is that low income is we can have discretion, but transitional is a shall, that I think that's relevant when you look at what you have to fund and what then you have discretion or need to take a council needs to approve by a formal vote, I would think. But
So this total cost here is all transitional then?
That was my question.
That's the shell.
So the 24 is considered transitional housing and it's a shell.
Yes.
Are there any of these homes here that fall under the category of what Councilmember Cutterback was pointing out, which would be the May column? Okay. Okay, any other questions?
Nope, that was it.
Thank you for following up on that. Councilmembers, do you have any questions? Okay. Do you have anything else, Diane? Okay. We're going to move to me now. So Gina's on vacation this week. Have a couple of things. One, for me, last week I went to Banjos and Bathrooms. That was put on as a fundraiser at the Wagner Arts Center. A lot of people showed up to that, some great music, and even Extapa here in town is the money that goes in their fountain is being donated to putting in improvements for bathrooms at Wagner Arts Center. So FYI on that. Also attended the Everett Community College board meeting last week and the award ceremony that the chamber put on here in town during a massive deluge. I mean, it dumped and it looked like a 6-inch fire hose was just shooting water off the top of the high school last week. I was happy to be inside. So that was Thursday, yeah. A couple of emails that our city clerk asked that I share with you. The first item is council vacation absence schedule. We want to make certain that you let us know of any possible vacations and absences throughout the rest of the year so that we know when we might have a potential quorum issue. The next item is the joint school board city council meeting. Please let us know if you're going to be joining us on Monday, July 21st from 6 to 7 p.m. For a presentation on what's proposed relative to the school improvements for the bond that they're considering for next year. So please RSVP to Liz. Okay. And I think that's all that I had. We do have a need for executive session, and so we will be going into executive session for pricing of property. Oh, before we do that, the agenda for next week. That's what I was thinking of. If you take a look at the agenda for next week, and Brad? Can you go follow up with Jane? Oh,
yeah.
I wasn't aware of their...
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, no.
All right. So let's go over the agenda for next week. We have introduction of our new police officer, our new canine, Nuke, presentation from Senator Kirk Pearson, proclamation. We've got some items under consent. New business. Does anybody have any questions about the agenda, the draft agenda for next week? Okay. Any questions about the extended agenda, and is anybody going to be absent any of those days in the extended agenda that you know about? Okay, Councilmember Cutterback?
Yes, I will be absent. I'll be gone August 5th, but it looks like that's canceled in August 12th.
So August 5th is not yet canceled. That's okay. National Night Out. So we'll mark you down as being absent that day.
The 5th and the 12th.
The 5th and the 12th. Okay. So we'll let the extended agenda show that. Councilmember Gamble?
I'm on vacation the first 2 weeks of July, so I should also show absent on July 1st.
Okay. So our city clerk will show that as well. Okay, Councilmember Rasmussen?
I'll be out on July 22nd.
July 22nd, okay. Okay, and so currently we still have a meeting scheduled for July 1st and also for August 5th. Again, we are marking a possible cancellation on August 5th, and at this point in time, unless council makes a motion to cancel July 1st, we're still on for July 1st. All right. So do we have anybody to report out on executive session then? Okay, perfect. We do have a need for executive session this evening, and we are going to move into executive session for pricing of property, RCW 4230110, subsection 1, subsection C, for approximately 15 minutes. There is
no action anticipated afterward.
Aside from adjournment, there's no action anticipated following the executive session. Thank you. And Brad, you're going to stay here.
Point of order.
Yes.
For the cancellation of the July 1st meeting, that meeting has no items listed on it at this point. And our deadline for staff to put anything on that particular council meeting is tomorrow. For noticing purposes, it would be wonderful if we could know whether the meeting is going to be canceled or not so that we can properly notice the cancellation of the July 1st meeting.
Okay.
So that's just the reason why it keeps coming before you.
I thought we already canceled.
So we haven't canceled it yet. Okay, and so we're still on the record. Keep the door open. Okay, Councilmember Camp?
I move that we cancel July 1st.
Okay. Second. I have a first and a second from Councilmember Rasmussen. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 4-0. The July 1st meeting is canceled. Thank you.
And let me, if I may, make another point of order just on the August 5th meeting. My understanding is that there is a large event hosted by the city at Lake Tai. And so the options would be either to not cancel the meeting, hold it on August 5th, to cancel the meeting for August 5th, or to reschedule the meeting on August 5th to a later time, possibly the day following. So those would be the options. Just keep in mind so that we can effectively, again, advertise for those items. So you don't, obviously we have a little time to address that if you don't want to address that tonight. So. That was just wanted to make sure that you saw why that keeps coming back on the agenda for your consideration. Thank you.
Councilmember Gamble.
I will be in attendance on the National Night Out. I think this we've supported every year. So I would like to make a motion that we cancel the August 5th meeting, and in keeping with the tradition of all of us being out there and supporting the National Night Out event.
Second.
I have a first from Councilmember Gamble, a second from Councilmember Cutaback. Councilmember Camp, did you have anything?
I did.
Okay.
Since we are dealing with a very small quorum, we're missing three members, I would like to recommend that we reschedule August 5th to July 29th. It gives us the option. We could always cancel it at a later date.
There's a motion on the floor.
Which I will be voting against. I would like to see a reschedule just to give the other members an option.
And the maker of the motion, again, the motion has to be voted on. So the maker of the motion and the second can, of course, vote against the motion if they want to. Is that correct?
That is correct. You could also choose to amend the motion to cancel the 5th and propose a reschedule to the 7/29 date.
I like to vote.
Do you want to vote?
Could I make a comment?
Yeah, it's now time for discussion. So he's made a motion to amend the motion.
You've made a, I don't think he made a motion.
I just made a comment.
Yeah, he just said he's going to be voting against it.
Okay.
So we have three meetings in July, July 8th, 15th, and 22nd. 22nd doesn't have anything on it yet. So to schedule the 29th, I mean, I think we still have an opportunity to move items at a full open agenda. And just for the past, this is my fifth year on council, we had a lot of discussion about National Night Out and how, because it didn't used to be canceled, the council meeting, and how important it is that, you know, that council is at that event, the city event, and, you know, so we've had a lot of discussion over that with other council members present at the time. Not saying I'm speaking for them, but so that's why I have no problem voting for the motion tonight and saying that August 5th is not, you know, that we cancel that meeting. The 22nd, we have a lot of opening for items. So, yeah.
Good. Yeah, you're up.
My only concern is the fact that we've had a cancellation every month. Well, this will be 3 months in a row. I just want to make sure that we are covered. And whether or not we have something on July 22nd, yeah. I want to make sure that we have that we have plenty of time and opportunity to do whatever city business we need to. I will be attending the August 5th mm-hmm. night out. I don't have a problem with that. I just making a blanket, let's cancel it tonight without input from the other members of the council, kind of bothers me. That's my only issue. We could always reschedule it, put it up to a vote when people are back and be done with it, which would make me happy. I'd be more comfortable with that.
I'd like to vote.
Well, the motion's on the table.
Any other discussion? Okay, seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Motion passes 3-1 with Councilmember Kant dissenting. Okay. Anything else before we go into executive session? Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and read again. We're going into executive session for pricing of property, RCW 42-30-110-1c. For approximately 15 minutes, the only item anticipated for action following this will be adjournment. And we are now in executive session. And we are back in session, out of executive session, Council. There being no other business, is there a motion for adjournment? Councilmember Gamble.
Move to adjourn.
Second.
I have a first from Councilmember Gamble. I have a second from Councilmember Cutterback. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes 4-0. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.